HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to the Investor Hour podcast. I'm your host, Rahul Goyal. The goal of this podcast is to learn from the best investment minds of our times. We want to learn their backstory, essentially, what makes them, them. We want to learn how they make their decisions in their personal lives. And of course, we want to learn about their core principles of investing. Essentially, a lot of learning that could help you make better decisions in life and investing.
Sridhar Sivaram talks about the importance of macro when picking stocks, the power of position sizing, and the criticality of overall asset allocation. Sridhar also discusses the story behind the famous, or rather infamous, Morgan Stanley Growth Fund, what went right and what went wrong and why. Sridhar also talks of value versus growth, what he has been preferring, and how his preference is starting to change. As always, we cover a lot more ground. A must listen.
Sridhar, hi. Welcome to the Equity Master Investor Hour. It's a delight to have you. Been trying to get you for some time. I know my mail landed in spam and you reached out. And so thank you for that. But
thanks for inviting me.
Great. So as always in the Investor Hour, we'd like to start right from the beginning. So tell us a little bit about yourself, in the sense where you grew up, how was the environment in your home, were there IPO firms, investment firms, were your parents investors? Take us through the early part of your life.
Yeah, so actually my father had a transferable job. So even though I'm from Kerala, I've hardly stayed there. I studied in Lucknow for about 7-8 years. And then most part of my education was in Calcutta. That's where I finished my college, my CA, CS, ICWA. And my first, introduction to stock market was when I did my industrial training with ANZ Brindley's Bank in their investment bank as part of my CA training. And I guess that was the first time I got introduced. Our office was so close to the Calcutta Stock Exchange, and we used to regularly file for IPO. This is back in 91, 92. So that was my first introduction, going to the, Ring and Calcutta Stock Exchange. Initially, I had no clue what people were screaming about. But over a period, I guess it all started to make sense. And plus, when you're doing your CA, you understand about finance and accounting and what this is all about. So I would say that is my, very early introduction to stock market, not from any stock market background, family. Father had never invested. So that's how I would put it, that I was lucky to, be part of the investment bank in Grinley's, which introduced me to the markets.
So you mentioned your father was in a transferable job. Was he in a government job or?
No, he was with the Sarabhai Group. He was in their accounts. So he was transferred to multiple parts of their organizations.
I heard the word accounts and I note that you also did the CA.
very much in the family.
Okay. And ANZ Grindley's, I remember those days it had a pretty significant presence in India. Is my understanding correct?
That's right. So I completed my CA. I did about 1.5 years of industrial training there. But then I got my first job with Citibank in 92. And I moved on to Mumbai then. And it so happened that, 1.5 years in Citibank, in the corporate bank, somehow I wasn't feeling to be in the right place. And I was looking for opportunities to get back to the stock markets in some form or the other. So that's when Morgan Stanley happened. So this was in 94 when Morgan Stanley hired just 4 or 5 people in the team. I joined immediately after the IPO. So there was quite a bit of chaos in the office almost every day. But as somebody with just few people in the organization, you were doing multitasking. So it was a great experience initially to do multiple parts of organization.
When you say IPO, you refer to the Morgan Stanley Growth Fund, the famous,
yes. 1994. January was the IPO. I joined sometime in March, April.
Yeah. So we'll come to that. I just want to step back a moment and go back to Calcutta. So why do you buy at ANZ? You were, they were doing IPOs and you were going to the stock exchange and filling in the forms and all. Those days, everything was manual, fill in the form.
Yes. Yeah.
And Calcutta was, even then, wasn't, now I'm with all, you know, disclaimers, wasn't it like the den of most of the big traders in India?
It was. So I, as I said, my baptism to the stock markets was in the big bad world. So there were so many scams going on in Calcutta. But then you also had a chance to learn. And working in Grinlays, we would not do many of the transactions because of a lot of the compliance issues that they had. But I had quite good bosses who explained to me why we would do and why we wouldn't. So it was a learning process. But I did make a lot of friends in Calcutta, which helped me in later part of the years when I was in Morgan Stanley.
When the whole Harsha Mehta thing broke up, anyone who studied it knows that a whole chunk of it was happening out of Calcutta, I would assume, right?
Very much, very much.
Do you remember any of the IPOs that you carried the forms, filled in the forms and submitted to the exchange?
Most of the companies are non-existent now, actually, unfortunately. I remember there was a company called HDC, which was in steels, but that company doesn't exist, or maybe it got merged or something happened. But most of the companies actually, from whatever I remember, did not make it for another 5-10 years. So because there were IPO booms that were happening in those days. So any Tom, Dick and Harry would come to the market. So I don't remember any successful ones who made it at that time. That's my faint remembrance.
There is something to be said about IPO booms coinciding with stock market booms and those companies not lasting for long, right?
Yes, very much.
Again, there's a lesson in there for people who are focused only on IPOs, I guess. So you were there, then you, of course, moved to Morgan Stanley in 1994. This is when their big Morgan Stanley growth fund issue had closed, or were you part of the issue process?
No, I joined after the issue closed. So it, strangely enough, they needed a company secretary. So I actually joined them because I had the secretarial qualification. And they also were looking for somebody who had a CA background to do some bit of financial control. As I said, I did multiple tasks in Morgan Stanley. And those days, markets were open only for 2 hours, between 12 and 2. So I used to trade for the funds between 12 and 2. And then between the trading, I would take care of the secretarial and the financial control part of the job and to some extent taxation. So it was like crazy. I mean, I had like multiple hats.
Multiple hats, more than multiple hats. So, in many of our investor hour sessions, we've come across money managers and all with illustrious track records like yourself who started their careers in the early 90s, right? And one talking point time and again becomes the Morgan Stanley Growth Fund. Now, with the hindsight of, nearly 30 years, what was that episode like? Because, we've all heard of queues stretching up to the Churchgate station from the stock exchange, which is probably a kilometer and a half. We've heard about people paying a premium to buy a mutual fund unit.
Yeah.
And of course, then, I think it went through a mixed performance. Ultimately, I did think, I do vaguely recollect it became an open-ended fund and it did well. But take us through that whole experience and tell us a little bit about what happened later.
So actually it was, I would say sort of missold. It was a mutual fund. And for the first time you had a MNC who had started a asset management company in India and was launching a closed-ended fund. And those days, closed-ended funds were common. Actually, more closed-ended funds were there at that time than open-ended fund. If you remember, all the master shares and master gains of UTI were all closed-ended funds. I think the problem was most because this also coincided with the IPO boom. So most people bought it assuming that this is an IPO and not a mutual fund. And the other thing was that there was a greenshoe option collect. The issue size was 300 and it could have, it was up to about 900 crores in those years. So actually, almost everybody who wanted actually got their shares. But actually, in terms of performance, the first year actually was a very good performance. In terms of performance, the performance was very good. Credit to Vinod Sethi, Akash Prakash, who were the portfolio managers at that point of time. But in mutual fund, you don't look at absolute performance. You look at relative performance to the benchmark, and the fund actually did very well in the first year. But unfortunately, the NAV was below 10, and the market price was trading possibly 20-30% below the NAV. So I guess that
because it was listed on the exchange.
So that resulted in all the bad press and the whole the noise about poor performance. But standalone, if you just look at performance of the mutual fund, I mean, it did have issues with performance also later on. But I would say the first year actually had a good performance. So that's where I would leave it. And then it was, over the period, others came in and launched mutual funds. They were open-ended and there was more criticism because this had a tenure of 15 years and stuff like that.
But just one more point on Morgan Stanley Growth Fund. If you look back at the portfolio you guys built out there in 1994, what comes to your mind? Was it like a good solid portfolio? Because after 94, even the markets crashed, right?
One can always. So I think there were too many regulatory issues also at that point of time. So you had to get, as per the SEBI regulations, you had to get about 85%, if I remember correctly, invested within the first 6 months. And also what also happened was Morgan Stanley at that time launched a number of international funds. So we had 900 crores of funds from Morgan Stanley Growth Fund. I think we had about 2,500 or 3,000 crores of money from FII investments, which also had to get invested. Relatively, these numbers look very small in today's context, but in those days, these were fairly substantial. And I remember I was on the trading desk and my job was, if you get any block, just close it. So that's it. It didn't matter what the stock was because we were in a hurry to get invested because we would have breached the guidelines.
So that 85% now is 65%, right? Now?
Correct. So that would have got adjusted, but I guess that was the challenge that in the first year, I think the fund ended up with almost 300 stocks. And then over a period, this was rationalized and, the portfolio was brought to some sort of manageable levels, I would say, over the years. But that was a challenge. And also, as you said, that September 94 was the peak of the market. And then I think we saw the index very close to that only sometime in 2000. So you're talking of, my starting in the markets was actually through a 6-7 year bear market. So which is why it is very difficult for me to get bullish.
You've been primed for a bear market, huh? Always looking for the downside. That tends to work out well in the long term, actually, for many. So you were trading over there, but tell us, at what point did you get around to making your first personal investment? And tell us a little bit about the, if you can share the name of the stock, the little bit of the story behind it.
Actually, my personal investments, I would say, given that the fund was fairly large, and I think for the first 4-5 years, we were not allowed to invest in the market at all as part of the compliance. And then we got some relaxation and we were allowed to invest and we had to hold it for a year. And by the time all this happened, I think it was 98, 99, when we got some sort of a clearance. And I ended up buying rubbish tech stocks. And they all double, tripled. I don't even remember the name. But I would say I just got lucky because I wanted to buy a house. And just to buy a house, I needed some capital. I ended up selling most of the tech stocks, which within 5 months fell 99%. Many of them, I don't think, are listed. So I think it was more a luck than anything else. So I wouldn't say anything about my initial investments. Thanks to my, buying a house resulted in me exiting some of those stocks. Actually, people who have lived through 99-2000 will realize that we haven't yet seen a bull market of that stature where, stocks will go up circuit to circuit for maybe 4-5 months. And those were really crazy days. But having lived through that, I guess those were my initial investments. And I would say very lucky, had nothing to do with any skill at all. But over that period, I was understanding how to analyze balance sheets. And I've seen from very close quarters, the fund managers struggling because even good companies with good results were not resulting in any reward as far as market price is concerned, because we are going through very tough bear markets. Even within Asia, you had the Asian crisis at that point of time. So the macro environment wasn't that great for equities at that point of time, which is when I understood about, you know, how macro is important. So a lot of learnings happened during those bear phases, I would say.
So you say macros are important, but a lot of the gurus, and starting with Mr. Buffett, would say you don't worry a lot about the macros because it's so difficult to predict. But I think from experience, you've seen that macros can play a big role on, you know.
Yeah, so I guess there are different styles people have, at least from the school that I have come through. You know, we've always played a lot of importance on macro, and I've typically seen that if macros are conducive, then, you know, you can end up with disproportionate returns. And as I've seen very closely, that between 94 and 99, actually between 94 and 2003, actually, if I remove those TMT stocks, which went up and came down, the market didn't do anything for 9 years. And it was a really painful period for some of the fund managers. And fortunately, I wasn't managing. I was started off as a trader, then as an analyst. I was still learning the ropes, tricks, and,
and
how to get
out at the peak. You were the lucky guy.
That was totally luck.
Totally luck, but what luck, right? Really. So that you got away with. Let's take you at your word. You got away with it, right? Let's say no skill, luck. But do you recollect making an investment which actually went bad? And talk to us about that, the story and the learnings.
I think in 2000, you know, I would say 2008, I think, when the market started to correct, you know, you didn't know the extent or scale of the correction that is going to happen. And in those phases, you know, definitely I had made, you know, some mistakes for the personal portfolio also, and even for the fund. And I guess you learn, because that was again such a big macro shock that we had never seen anything in that scale, and no amount of bottom fishing worked at that time.
Yeah.
So I guess those were learnings that you know, sometimes you have to just respect the macro and, you know, stay away, be on the sideline, and see how things play out.
2008 long, or you sold at the bottom? What really happened?
So I would say entering into 2007, we were quite cautious. Actually, we hardly participated in, you know, any of the, you know, IPOs at that point of time. We didn't participate in the real estate bubble that was happening at that time. But still, there were always, you know, some stock or the other, because the carnage was so huge, and it actually almost encompassed the almost, I would say, 90-95% of the market, that there was no place to hide. And, you know, in some of the mid caps and small caps, I would say, the ones where you had to take a bigger hit than the normal. I would say 2008, actually, we outperformed. But 2009 was the difficult year, because 2009, the market rebounded very sharply, and we were still holding a defensive portfolio, and we underperformed in 2009, but that helped us later. So in hindsight, it played out well over a period of time.
And do you attribute the playing out well to just like buying and holding quality stocks, or having pivoted at the right time?
So I would say that a bit of both. So I remember sometime in 2000, I would say September or October of 2009, where I made a presentation to my that time boss, Rachel Sharma, that And he was the head of emerging markets. And emerging markets, because it's a large portfolio, you cannot have so many stocks. So you would normally have, okay, 10 stocks from India and things like that. And I had made a presentation showing how the staples, which are the FMCG stocks, the premium to the market was at the lowest in the last 20 years at that time. And this was quite an anti-consensus call at that point of time, because people were running back or rushing back into the cyclicals and the high beta stocks. And here I was making a presentation of buying staples. And to buy staples in the size that we needed, I'm talking of, say, $100 to $200 million for the emerging market funds, maybe similar size for the domestic funds. It was a fairly substantial purchase. And the liquidity was not supportive. So we had to buy a basket. So that's when I made the presentation that you just buy a basket of, you know, everything, Asian Paints to Godrej to HUL, ITC, and, whatever you can buy in that Colgate. One of the reasons at that time also was the government was also stimulating the economy through fiscal stimulus. And the call was that this will result in more consumption. So it did play out very well, because not only did the companies get earnings growth, I think they had their best decadal re-rating after that. I mean, I can remember that Asian Paints at that time was in the teens in terms of the PE. Colgate and all the others, Nestle, they were all in the 18 to 20 band in terms of the P. And this, at that time, it was the lowest that it had seen. So it just played out very well. But it was, there was no instant gratification, because you carried through some underperformance for 6 months. And it's only after that you saw the fruits. So I guess that's the...
Yeah, that's a great call, because I remember that I think HUL, Hindustan Unilever, those days Hindustan Lever, probably had gone through a 10-year period with point-to-point, no change in price.
Yes, yes. Yes. And many of the other staples also. I guess what also happened was many of the large holders were getting frustrated, and that's how we got blocks. I have to thank some of the securities broking guys who helped me get some blocks, because I'd left open mandates that any staples FMCG company, don't even come to me, just close the block.
Wow.
So it did work out.
In this conversation, one thing I find very interesting, you're referring to buying blocks, because as an individual, if you want to take exposure to FMCG in 2009, it's quite easy, right? You could just go out and buy, there's enough liquidity, but when you're buying, you have to buy a minimum amount.
Yeah. So actually, very early, I realized that position sizing in your portfolio is very important. Like if I buy a stock in my portfolio and it is 25 or 50 basis points, if it doubles, it basically adds 50 basis points to my performance, which is often a rounding off error. When you're managing large portfolios, you have to ensure that your position size, if you have conviction, is good. And that I learned very early. And which is why I said blocks, because these stocks you could never buy on the screen. The impact cost would have been so high that it would have been detrimental to our own objective of trying to build a portfolio. But being patient, we did manage to buy significant amounts of blocks, getting other funds to sell. That's how most funds actually in those days were, because the liquidity in barring the top 20, I would say liquidity in many of the other stocks are not that great.
So position sizing is one of our favorite topics, and we're going to come to that a little later. But sure. I just want to, so we've spoken about the Harshad Mehta period. You sidestepped it. You got lucky in the TMT. You've spoken to us about the learnings in the great financial crash or crisis, whatever it's called. Talk to us about the pandemic. With all this learning behind you, how did you... Tell us about when did you sort of realize something's going wrong? Did you take any action? And how did March, April 2020 play out for you?
So our view was very clear that we'll follow the US markets. And we are happy to miss the first 10%, because this is something that's happening for the first time. And we have no clue, no way of analyzing it. So we did raise cash in March. We were slightly ahead, I would say, not very ahead, but early March, we started to get some sense that there's something bad which could happen, especially because there were people from UK who were doing calls, especially from the Wellcome Trust, who were involved with pandemic and very closely involved with WHO. I happened to be in one of those calls. Obviously, a lot of their predictions were wrong because their predictions were very scary. But having said that, we also got scared looking at what they were projecting, and we did raise cash sometime in March, and our view was very clear. A lot of them looked very attractive as the prices were falling, but as a house, we kept a discipline that we happy to miss the first 10%, but follow the US markets because we have no idea of how this will play out.
Markets would know, the US markets would get the first hint. Can be tackled or not.
Yeah, so the other thing we did was value over growth at that point of time, because one, we didn't know what we were entering into. So our view was that let's look at value over growth, which is where I have earnings cushion, where I have price to book cushion, and build a portfolio based on that. It's not that you're always zero invested, right? Your whatever cash you've created, you're trying to deploy that, or you're trying to reposition your portfolio. So I think during the pandemic, I would say that's how things played out, that I would say mid-April, May is when we were looking to seriously invest. But the idea was value over growth. I mean, commodities were the very obvious ones. I mean, they were trading at point to book at that time. So they were, and as a house, our house is very strong with their projections on commodity. And even during 2003 in Morgan Stanley, we had taken a fairly aggressive position on commodities because they were at almost similar levels. I remember I messaged my ex-boss that, commodities are, almost at the same price to book as it was in 2003.
I think whenever I think of the pandemic and in hindsight, it appears to be a smart call to have gone all in March. But the fact is, a lot of the people were running blind and it could have gone either way. So when you say you were looking at the US market, it's pretty counterintuitive. But the way I'm reading it is that you're basically looking for a signal that the market has figured out that it's going to get worse or it's going to get better.
Yeah, that's the mother of all markets. So there was no point
me.
No point me betting against the mother of all markets. So it was easier to take the call that let's take cues from the U.S. market and allow the first 10% to go through, because you could have false starts. So I would say, to be honest, all of us were blind.
That's so, right. And if you remember, I think Munger spoke sometime in March, and he said the same thing. He says, we'd like to come out with more cash on the other side of this than less cash. Basically, he was saying we're going to be very conservative. But after that, of course, the situation changed. There was news started trickling in. I don't recollect exactly when the news came out about the vaccine.
I think, in November, I think. October or November.
Oxford vaccine was the first news that filtered through. So that's your, the journey across the crisis, which overlaps perfectly with your career graph. Now let's move to the little bit meat of this, right? Let's talk about stock selection process. Now, you already given us a hint that you look at macros, but let's leave the macro aside. I'll come back to that later. Let's talk about stocks. So how would you define your stock selection process?
I think it comes back to macro, that if the macro is conducive, then you would look at a bit more aggressive stock selection, which is if your domestic macro is conducive, then you would first, that's how at least I have, I'm not really bottom up, which is look at the stock from down and then try to fit it in a portfolio. Because of the size of the portfolio that we were managing and the fact that in my earlier part of the career, and anybody who's managing a benchmark portfolio, you're slaves to the benchmark. So you are trying to fit things in and around the benchmark and then take the deviation for the alpha that you would generate. So that's how I would say that, depending on macro. So I would give you an example of, say, 2013 and 14, which were actually very good years for our fund in Morgan Stanley, because in 2013, the macro was looking very bad and we had a very defensive portfolio. And as things turned out during 2013, you know, India went into the Fragile Five, we had inflation issues, and then we had, you know, rate tightening from Raghuram Rajan, and that also was very aggressive. As we were heading into 2014, I would say November, December, at least my call was, and we had difference of opinion within our office itself in Morgan Stanley. But the fund that I managed, I took a position that these macro call, the changes that have happened to rates and inflation would significantly come off over the period of next 6 months. And we didn't have any idea of what will happen to the election. And my view was, whatever happens to the election, the macro is going to look far better. And we couldn't have had worse coalition governments than what we've had in the previous two. So it can only look better from here. So there was no reason to hide in IT and pharma. And it was time to get into domestic cyclicals. So it was time to look at domestic stocks. So it was just a large call. And once you do that, then you just buy, you know, the top 5-6 names that you can in each of those sectors in the domestic cyclicals. So you're really not trying to, you know, do very much bottom up, but you do bottom up only to the extent that, okay, I need to buy, say, you know, 20% in financials, or I need to up my position by 20% in financials. Then what would I buy? Obviously, some of the existing stocks, but that wouldn't add up for the size that we manage. So then you would add up a few more. PSU banks, which you would normally not own, that was the easiest to buy, because if that's the call. So that's how I would say that stock selection and macro, they're so linked. If you're managing a sized portfolio, if you're managing a small portfolio, it's fine. I can, you know, bottom fish. I can go to the, you know, small cap, mid cap, and, you know, find some jewels there. I don't think I have the skills to do that because I've never done it.
Yeah. But I like the way you mentioned it, that even if it's a coalition government, it couldn't be worse than what we've already had. So the bear in you had protected your underside. You knew that the downside can't be worse than what we've seen.
Actually, we have a group of fund managers who meet very regularly in Mumbai. Almost, I would say, 15 of us. And we meet for lunch and we exchange ideas. And we had a bet sometime in August. And one of the, you know, famous fund manager, I won't name him, he had said that BJP will get 150 for the 2014. And I was at 200 plus. And the bet was that the next lunch he would sponsor.
After the
Yeah, obviously the number was far higher. Also, I end up doing a lot of road trips. So I travel a lot to the interiors. Also because I'm into wildlife, so I go to the jungle. So most of the time you are in deep part of the, you know, interior part of the country. And on the way, I normally stop down at, you know, at some chai stop, or, you know, have some samosa and chat with people there. And I think I got a broad sense that we are in for a surprise. Surely not to the extent that we got from the elections, but I was reasonably sure to expect that we would get a better coalition than what it was. So that gave me more confidence in terms of positioning. As I mentioned earlier, position size matters a lot. I think in 2014, our fund had a, you know, I think 20% alpha. So the fund outperformed the benchmark by 20%. So which never happens, actually. This is so outlied, yeah. But and possibly the best performance I had in my career. But
that the wildlife trips paid off. All the chai and the chai stalls paid off. Huh?
It paid off a lot. Yeah. It paid off a lot. So I would say it does help.
I'm sure some of the credit goes to your Xbox, Mr. Ruchir Sharma, who's been traveling the country before every election.
And we had a difference with him, by the way.
Yeah, he was
in
not
that on trip. No, it is only sometime in April that he actually started to believe what I started to say, because unfortunately, he also travels with people who have a certain ideology and are not wanting to see the other side. Whereas you have to have an open mind when you're meeting people. So I guess, but in sometime in April, he did realize that what I was saying is what could happen. Yes.
Interesting. Talking about macros again. So the I like the idea of the way you talk about it and the way you follow it is that the macro is the tailwind. If the tailwind is in your favor, all you have to do is get the broad stocks right, as against picking up the perfect stock that is going to beat all adversity and come out on top. So I would guess both the strategies, like you have said at the beginning of that, you know, there are multiple approaches, but the macro approach, I think has a resonance to it, but to understand the macro is tough, right? I think you, when you speak, you can easily get, you've got a global perspective. I ask you about the pandemic, you say, you know, you're looking at the US market. That's not the first answer that comes to, you know, most of us and most of the listeners. So this strategy, of course, has worked well for you. You've been following it for 20 years or 20 plus years. Could you maybe give us a little more color to it, a little more examples, a little more downside, what people who are watching and listening can keep in mind when they try and start thinking from a top-down perspective, which is macro first?
So I think it also comes from the fact that I was part of emerging markets team. As you know, my ex-boss, Richard Sharma, was very a macro person. Our team itself was very macro-oriented. So I would give credit to the entire Morgan Stanley macro team to have inbuilt some sort of a discipline in terms of looking at the macro. Because in India, I don't think too many people look at macro the way we do. So I think it is something that has to come over a period of time, because generally it is believed that you just look at the stock and then you buy. I'm not disputing that. So what we used to do is get the macro right and then look at the stock and then see if it fits into the overall strategy. Yeah, there are exceptions where you meet an exceptional company and you think, okay, this is too good to be true, or this is so good, doesn't matter what the macro says. You build a portfolio and stay with that over a period of time. But I would say that these are really small data points. No, I mean, you look at what's happening to inflation domestically, look at what's happening to inflation in the US or UK, try and project how it could move. Over the years, I've built my own inflation model for India. It's not very difficult because it's an index. And you know how this index has moved over the last 10 years. You have all the data. So like for this year, I can say that the inflation, my own model is not working because the inflation is much higher than what I would have projected. And my gut feel is that RBI will miss the fourth quarter guidance that they have given. They have, I think, projected 5.8% average inflation for Q4 of this financial year. I don't see how that you know, happens. I'll be happy if that happens and I'm wrong, because that's good for the market. But just giving you a data point, because when you track these inflation numbers so closely, you know where it can go and how things can go wrong. So I think there is no right or wrong answer. You have to track a lot of data points when you're saying macro, and you need to track them on a regular basis.
And macro, of course, if you're looking top down, you're looking at the country level, right?
Yes.
Direction, yes. It's headed, how's inflation and all that. Then you're also looking sectoral, the mega trends and the mega themes.
Yeah, so that's how I would you know, phrase macro as a starting point for me, and then you know, fit in the puzzles, the missing links in terms of buying the stocks after that.
Yeah, and I was also asking you about the mega trends, like you know, you've got the economy right, then you're trying to get the industry right, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. So I would say, like, mega trends, one of the mega trends that we looked at sometime in 20, as I mentioned, value over growth, because growth was being priced in for you know, as if they're going to continue for infinity. You know, I remember sometime in 2 years back, which is 2020, we were somebody had requested that we take a Zoom meeting with a PSU chairman. And I said, I'm not going to invest in a PSU bank. What is the point? So he said, at least you'll get some sense of what's happening. And I told my partners that, okay, let's take the call, because government is doing a lot of credit guarantee schemes. At least we'll get a sense of what's happening, because these banks were lending a lot to MSMEs and stuff like that. And as the meeting progressed, we realized that his pre-provision profit was higher than his market cap. And I said, oh my God, this is has to be crazy. Yeah. So then we checked. Obviously, we took a substantial position, but company also did a QIP. Stock is up 3 times from where we actually met. And we did then checked all the other PSUs to check what is happening. We were already in that value versus growth, but somewhere you miss a lot of these because you feel these are non-investable. But I guess they had reached such lows that it was very difficult to lose from there. So I guess the mega trend was already there. It was just a question of repositioning and looking at some of the ideas which you had missed. And those sort of trends have played out. We're still in that value versus growth, preferring value. But I would say at the margin, we are now tilting or looking at growth because growth stocks have really corrected a lot. 50, 60, some of the new age technology stocks, 70-80%. So we are starting to look at their business models, see if some of them make sense. But our tilt is still towards value.
So what I'm taking away is that you think macro, but your eyes and ears are always open. Suddenly you come across a stock, whose profits are more than the market cap. You jump at it. So you're always like looking around. You mentioned, high tech stock, the tech stocks. And obviously what comes to mind are really the US stocks, because they are the real tech stock, which have all collapsed.
But also in India, a lot of the new age tech stocks got listed last year and, the valuation just didn't make sense at that time, at least to us. And one of the points I've always highlighted is I've lived through 2000, where we gave 50 times revenue multiple to Infosys and Wipro. They were not bad companies. They were actually great companies, but it's just that we were giving them a wrong value. And it took 7-8 years for those prices to come back. In fact, if you look back at Zee Telefilm, it's still not reached its 2000 high, and you're talking of 22 years. So, and it's still a good company. So I think it's a question is, what is the price you're paying for a good company? And at least it didn't make sense for us last year. Now, some of it is, making sense. We're trying to understand what's happening there. What is the business model? And then we'll take it forward from there. If things work out, then we may invest.
Great. Okay. So for the viewers, think macro, be flexible. Don't get compartmentalized. Portfolio construction. So this is where we talk sizing, but I'm going to request you, Sridhar, to think like an individual investor. Our typical viewer, listener is an individual. Talk about portfolio construction. Talk about position sizing. This is the moment where we think that, we need to delve deeper into this topic.
Actually, as an individual, you want to diversify. Because your job is not to invest in stock markets. You have your own some other job, and you are just investing because either you have a passion for investing or you want to create wealth for yourself. So the portfolio sizing has to be very different from how it will be for a mutual fund. I would say that for a fund, the top 10 stocks possibly have to be about at least around 35-40% of your portfolio, because then only it will give you the position sizes right, because the top stock, top 3-4 stocks will be much higher weight, the 10th stock will be much lower weight. Whereas for an individual, it has to be a bit more diversified, because I'm not sure if he has the ability to track bad news which comes, and sometimes the corrections can be so vicious that he may lose a lot of the gains. My best advice to most people is that you're better off with a mutual fund as an individual, because a lot of these issues are taken care of because the mutual fund manager is doing this. And I'm not very sure if many individual portfolios have really outperformed. I'm sure there are, but I would say on an average, it's only the kick that you get. I'm not very sure if over, say, 5 years, 10 years, they've really outperformed the benchmark. If somebody has, then he's done a great job. But I would say on an average, most people wouldn't have outperformed. So what is the point apart from getting a key? You're better off with a mutual fund. I mean, that would be my broad advice.
Yeah. But given that, you know, a lot of our viewers are very stock focused and hopefully they've done well, typically how many stocks in a portfolio do you think an individual can handle?
I mean, surely not more than 30, 40, I would say.
I mean, I think so. The smaller the better, because you've got all the things in your life going on.
Yeah.
Professional funds these days have 30, 40 stocks. So, and they have teams of people tracking those companies.
Yeah, but individuals, what happens is you actually don't position size. You end up, you know, buying a lot of these IPOs, or somebody gives a tip, you buy some stock, it goes up, then you don't know whether you should buy or you should sell. I would say somewhere in that range, 30, 40, not more than that, should be the ideal position size.
So we had Vijay Kedia on the Investor Hour recently, and he spoke about betting big. So if you find the right stock, he believed that you have to bet big. I think something like what you're saying, that, you know, top 10 has to be 35, 40%, but the top one or two stocks, you have to put more money in it.
Yes.
So I guess that's where it comes to sizing. So if you find a great stock and allocate 1% to it, and even if it doubles or triples.
Yeah, it doesn't add up. Yeah, so it has to be more than 5%. So often what happens as a fund, I can say that normally we would say that if I'm very bullish, it has to be 300 basis points over the benchmark. That should be my starting. And then if you're more bullish, then you take as you get more convinced, more data, then you take it higher. If you're 100 basis points over the benchmark, again, the same thing comes, because I'm used to a benchmark criteria. That's why I'm coming back to the benchmark. But if you don't have a benchmark, then somewhere in that 3-4% should be of your portfolio should be the minimum size. And if you're very bullish, then you take it up to 7-8%.
Yeah. And have you figured out, so, you know, no matter how much conviction you have in a stock, you could go wrong, right?
Yeah.
If you're taking a big bet is a big loss if you get it wrong. Have you figured out like a framework to prevent you from blowing up your portfolio just because you bet big on a stock? Is there like a red line?
I think the red line is the management quality and the amount of research that you do on a company. Even then you can go wrong, but your probability of going wrong goes down. So if you go wrong, even after that, it is mostly because some policy has changed, which has nothing to do with the company.
Which could have predicted, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is not something, or something like the pandemic happened and, you know, all the portfolio, you know, they blow up, something like that. But generally, I would say if you do your homework right, your management tick marks, your balance sheet tick marks, you're okay. You would. And I think one of the criteria we had is that if you can avoid accidents, then you tend to outperform, which is you don't want a stock down 50% in your portfolio. If you can avoid that, even if you're not, you know, getting all the upsides, you know, the other thing is you can't win all battles, right? So you know, fight only those battles which you understand. So, I mean, FOMO is the serious problem. So as a portfolio manager, I would say that I've avoided having FOMO. I've missed many, rallies like the real estate rally in 2007. We didn't participate in DLA. We didn't buy Unitech or any of the others. And I remember my boss was from Delhi and he was very unhappy because every time he went to a party in Delhi, he would be told, "Hey, you guys didn't participate in DLF. See, 500 has gone to 1,000. And then in 9 months, it was in two digits. But you know how bosses are. They don't remember what they said.
Yeah, that's true. So let's say, you know, you got this portfolio and you selected high conviction stocks, done your portfolio sizing and et cetera, et cetera. When and how do you decide to sell a stock? I guess bugbear of individual portfolios where people either hold on for too long or they sell too fast. So
I think it's the selling is always a tough, trade to have. I would say what happens is that when you find that the opportunity in some other stock is far better At least from a fund constraint, that was far easier because you were working with a limited pool of money and you're normally, I would say, 95% invested. So you find some other stock which is far more convincing, or if some of the parameters that you had set for the stock have reached, and even after, you know, reviewing some of the change matrix, you still find that these look interesting. But it's a very fluid answer that I'm giving because it changes from time to time, and there is no right answer for this. If you ask any fund manager, this is the most difficult part. When do you book profits? Yeah, and there's no right answer to it.
You're right, because the other thing is the whole emotional angle that comes into this, right? You are wedded to the stock, and how do you tell yourself, especially if the stock's gone the other way, that you were wrong, right? The whole psychology thing kicks in. So I like what you said. You can actually set out a predefined sell criteria that, you know, if this doesn't happen, you have to exit. So, you know, you're not kicking yourself. You say, I always planned it. But what if the stock's doing very well? Let's say you bought DLF in 2006 and you're riding it all the way up. And if you don't have a defined criteria, then that's like horrible, right?
Yeah. So actually the IPO came mid-2007. And within 6 months, it was doubled. And then you had the financial crisis and, you know, everything went for a toss. I mean, I can tell you why we didn't buy something like a DLF or any of the other, you know, real estate companies, Reliance Power. I mean, those were the famous IPOs which everybody participated and we stayed away, and we got a flak for many of them that you didn't participate. But in hindsight, it worked out. And I think it was a very simple philosophy that many of these companies were discounting their profits for 10 years of land bank or 12 years of land bank. And as I said, we were part of the emerging market scheme, and I've seen how similar Chinese companies were being valued. Not more than 3 years of land bank anybody was giving, you know, any multiple at all. Whereas we were happily giving multiples for 10 years land bank and 15 years land bank. Just didn't make sense for us. And when we did back calculation of number of households sold, and if you were to, you know, sell, make buildings for all the land and how many households, it wasn't adding up from a micro or from a macro standpoint. Same for Reliance Power, that it was a dream. You had nothing on the table. And I remember one of the investment bankers after my meeting gave me a spreadsheet saying that, Sridhar, this is the spreadsheet, the IRR. You put money for the entire IPO, then only you'll get allocation. And once you do that, your IRR is some 30% or something in 15 days or 20 days. And I was thinking, money making can't be so easy, right? That so obviously
simple,
that
becomes, but not easy.
Yeah. But that spreadsheet I still have. And I told the investment banker, who's a good friend, that the day I write a book, that spreadsheet goes into the book. Because that ensured that I should not invest. I was very clear as I was heading into my car and I looked at the spreadsheet. I said, okay, if I had any doubt, after seeing the spreadsheet, I know now, though, I surely should not put money in this.
Yeah. But when you talk of selling, I really, I think logically the right thing to do is if you get a better stock, you should switch, right? Because if the market's down, you're selling cheap, you're buying cheap. If the market's high, you're selling high and buying high. So, but it's just that whole psychological thing of getting over it that becomes a little more, makes the whole situation a little more challenging, I think.
That's right.
Moving on from portfolios and stocks, looking a little bigger, what do you think and how do you think about asset allocation for yourself? Different asset classes, your thoughts on that, and how do you go about planning that?
Yeah, so actually, I'm quite a bull on gold. And, you know, I have constant arguments with a lot of my fund managers who think gold is rubbish. And when you look at gold performance, and actually one of the points which they miss is that gold is actually a hedge for the currency.
Indian rupee.
So for so look at current gold performance for the current year, it's up 10%. It's beating the Nifty by say 3-4%. And you look at gold performance for say 5 years or say 15 years or 20 years, you would find that gold is roughly in line with Nifty, maybe 100, 200 basis points here and there. 15 years, it outperforms the Nifty. 20 years, it's maybe 100 basis points less than the Nifty. And I often say that I salute the Indian women. They are the best fund managers in the country, because by just buying gold, they've outperformed all the benchmarks for over a long period of time and even on the short period of time. And they didn't have to look at balance sheet. They didn't have to, you know, look at some, you know, P ratio, some crisis happening, COVID crisis, that crisis. Yeah. They've outperformed over a period of time. And I have constant arguments. I'm sorry, the problems of. So, as I said, that I have constant arguments with some of my, you know, fund manager friends on this. But, and the other thing is that the government has a great scheme as far as gold is concerned. The sovereign gold bond, if you see, you get 2.5% extra on that. Plus, it is tax free at the end of 7 years. If you add the 2.5%, gold beats Nifty by a big margin. Right. So. So I think, so I have 10% allocated to gold. That's because I'm also in the equity markets. So I understand equity. So I think there are better opportunities than equity. But for somebody who isn't, he should have a higher allocation to gold, because it's an asset class that, you know, has beaten inflation over a long period of time. And the government scheme is very good. As long as the government is giving you this scheme where you get 2.5% interest every year, plus it's tax-free at the end of 7 years. I mean, at least you should start with 5 or 10% and eventually take it higher.
Yep. So, as long as you're in India, which is capital hungry, we'll always be importing capital. We got a weaker currency in the long term. So that's your hedge. And probably, I think, 3 to 5% depreciation of the rupee over a long period of time is baked in. So by buying gold, you're hedging against that. But I just want to thank you for making that point, that even though you're in equity, you should consider some allocation to gold because it can do well. You know, a lot of the times I come across notes and publications where people proudly say they're 100% in equity. And I think that may be good for them, and that's fine. But I think it's maybe not the best message for the readers.
Because yeah, and even for them, my problem is that I've always seen that they try to put down gold by sending the dollar returns of gold. And I said, this is so unfair. You're comparing apples and oranges. And I've had arguments on WhatsApp. Some of them have got angry with me. And I said, the lady from Kolhapur has beaten you hands down, boss. You're feeling bad because of that.
She had all the free time in any case. She didn't have to run around like you're meeting companies, huh?
Yeah, so I said it's an asset allocation. Yeah. So each person has to do their own asset allocation. But the data is so strong that you'll be foolish to ignore it. That's all I can say. I mean, rest of it is your call. I mean, you want to invest your money the way you want.
What about real estate? Property, real estate?
Yeah, so real estate, I haven't invested in real estate apart from the house that I'm staying. Because it's a bit illiquid and my understanding of the market isn't so good. So I prefer to have, things which are more liquid. Obviously, some part of the money is in tax-free bonds and debt, maybe 15-20% you keep in debt. So it's not like I'm 100% or 90% invested in equity. That's not how it is. So I have a reasonable asset allocation, but real estate hasn't formed part. I don't understand that market so well, but I'm sure there are a lot of others who understand this better and have invested well in that.
Yeah, that's another great learning, right? You should do what you understand and what you don't probably give money to. Unfortunately, there are no real estate funds in India. There are REITs, which are very different from, you know, buying and selling real estate. That's different. Any other thoughts on asset allocation? Any other learnings, experiences you've had over time?
No, I think some part you can invest overseas if you want. But I think India's opportunity is so good. I wouldn't force people to, you know, invest overseas or in these overseas funds. But it's always good to, diversify into other parts. Especially as I said that because those are invested in a different currency, you also get the depreciation of currency benefit in it. So I think those are various ways of investing. But I think we have so much opportunity within India that you don't need to do all that. I mean, I think between gold and possibly equity and some debt, you can easily juggle and, make a good portfolio.
Yep, great. That's great advice. Moving to the last set of questions. So you have kids?
I do have.
Ages, roughly?
So my son is 24 and my daughter is 20.
Okay, so now the most difficult question. How are you teaching them about money and investing?
So my son is not interested in finance. So he's more interested in gaming. He's a gamer. So he's not interested. But my daughter is doing her CA.
That's where all the money is, by the way, in gaming.
She will manage the son's money. So my daughter is doing her CA, so she's interested in investing in stock markets. So I guess
it's kept alive.
Yeah, exactly. It's kept alive.
But a lot of people I talk to, teaching children is very difficult. Is about money, especially your own children, right? For whatever reason.
But so I believe that it should come on their own. So no point forcing. So no point forcing anything on them. So I didn't know that my daughter will do CA. It just happened that one day she said, Papa, I want to pursue CA. I said, wow. I mean, I was waiting for this day, but I'm happy that my son didn't say, but my daughter came and said this. We have a tradition of family which has a lot of CAs. My grandfather was a chartered accountant. I guess it helps.
Wonderful. Now, India needs a lot of CAs, by the way, given the amount of work that the government has put on us.
Yeah.
So we were in a 2-year pandemic. Your wife's probably saved up a lot of money, not much shopping, not much eating out. And she comes to you and says, hey, Sridhar, I've saved up a crore of rupees. What should I do with that? What would be your advice to her?
No, it will be the same as it was for the stock of the money that she would have had, which is maybe 50-60%. Should go depending on the age. I'm assuming she's not in the markets. That around 50-60% should go in equity in a mutual fund or whatever. I generally advise people that mutual fund is the best option. No point dabbling in stocks. But as you said, your viewers are people who understand stocks well, so they could look at stocks and invest there. I so strongly advocate gold. So I think that's something, specifically the sovereign gold bond, which the government issues. And then maybe some debt options. There are very interesting debt options these days because interest rates are going up. You have good companies offering yields closer to 9-10%. So
REITs are...
REITs also, some of the REITs are offering yields which are very attractive. So those are the other options you could look at and invest.
Yeah, by the way, I think we have Embassy REITs CEO Vikas on the show next. So we'll talk to him about the yields over there. You mentioned wildlife. We should ask you a little bit about wildlife. How did you get, pick that up?
As a fund manager, you are in a high-stress job. So you need to de-stress, and always had, some form of, de-stressing mechanism. I'm actively involved with sports. And the other thing is to travel. I think because of those issues, I was a very outdoor person because of my sports, and then traveling, trekking, that led to going to the jungles, and then I picked up photography. So then the passion for photography comes in, and that's how it built. So I'm quite a passionate wildlife photographer.
I did see something on your Twitter profile. Didn't one of your pictures win an award or something?
Yes, it did. Quite a few awards, actually. So Sanctuary Asia is one of the premier photography awards in India. My photograph did win third prize last year. I got some international awards last year also, which were few of them were the top awards.
Well, you spoke about multitasking at the beginning of the podcast. We should all remember that. Don't lose sight of that.
No, but as a fund manager, you need to de-stress because if you carry your portfolio home, then you tend to make more mistakes because it's not every day that your portfolio is doing well. And you tend to make more mistakes when your portfolio is not doing well. So I guess over a period, I realized that you need to you need to de-stress so that you're not making mistakes, especially when you're underperforming. Your pressure to outperform is so much that you end up chasing what is performing well, and that ends up doing the wrong thing. I'm giving you my gyan based on the mistake that I've made. So it is not that it came to me very normally. So we all made mistakes.
That's the kind of gyan that works, because it's real life, right?
And so we've learned from our mistakes, and then you try to ensure that you don't make the same mistakes again.
Yep. What are your thoughts on giving away wealth?
Yeah, so I do a lot of that for the wildlife community. So a lot of my charity goes into wildlife, because I'm very close to nature, and the people who are protecting these wildlife are very poorly paid, especially the the guards, the people inside the jungle who are trying to save the poachers. Man-human conflict in wildlife is so common because they're villagers next to the jungles, and we spend a lot of money through some NGOs, educating them, helping them. And also we put solar water pumps inside the jungle, because often the tigers specifically, they come out in search of water, because in the summers these water holes dry up. So I think large part of my giving goes into this. Some goes to some child education, but I would say very large part, because a lot of people are already doing the other part. The amount of charity that is going into wildlife, I know a lot of people talk about nature and, this is the in thing about environment, but I don't think enough goes to the people who require. So that's where a lot of my giving goes.
It makes me feel so nice. And, when you talk about the guards and all that, that doesn't come up in any list, right?
It doesn't come up. If I have to get some corporate CSR to do this, it takes a lot of presentation to get anybody to agree to do any of this. It's not the easiest thing, especially say in winters, it's so cold. And most of them, are patrolling the jungle with not even, proper gears. And we are expecting them that they have to fight the poachers. It's not an easy task. But yeah, I think a lot of help these days is coming. People are have understood about environment, wildlife protection. So yeah, the fight is going on.
More power to you. Yeah, have more success in that. Okay, now switching gears a bit again. You think macro. Macro is critical to you. And let's talk a little bit of India. Let's talk on India for a few minutes. India's had a couple of starts, right? 1991, 92 reforms were a big start. And I know I mentioned this in one of the earlier podcasts, and the guests immediately said that, no, that's not the case, primarily because to a lot of us, we feel that India has had a lot of stop and starts. Point to point, it appears everything looks great. But I guess within a few years of the 91 reforms, we were all like, okay, now it's ended. Nothing else is happening. And then another burst of reform. But this time, the kind of reforms we've seen, which have been a cumulative effect of the technology, the Aadhaar stack, or whatever you call it, people believe it's different and it's going to last. So talk to us about what you're thinking of India, its prospects. Are you in that camp that runway ahead of itself and this is the time to bet on India, and why?
Yeah, so I would go with a statement which my boss often used in his books, that India disappoints the optimist and the pessimist. So if you're very optimistic on India, you will get disappointed. And if you are very pessimistic, also you'll get disappointed. Our reforms are incremental in nature. So would I say in the last 6-7 years we've had reforms? Yes, we've had. But I would say there are a lot of disappointments also. I think PSU divestment is one that we've been talking about, structural PSU divestment for almost 5-6 years now. And there are a lot of starts and stops. So I would say that the pace of reform has surely moved up in the last few years. And when you compare that with other emerging markets, because I track many of them very closely, India does stack up very well in terms of the reforms that they have done. Could we have done more? Yeah, we could have. But I'm not going to nitpick. It's a democracy. It's a large democracy. There are a lot of challenges that the governments face. So I think I would say that in the next few years, possibly we'll see much more in terms of reforms. I'm quite optimistic as far as India is concerned from a macro standpoint, specifically when I look at other markets. And you mentioned how India has done over a period of time. And this is the statistics I often give that, you know, emerging markets over the last 5 years or 10 years, 15 years, they've not given any returns. I'm talking MSCI dollar returns. And in my past avatar, I've met many of the pension funds who actually put money in some of these emerging markets. And one of the basic pretexts was there's a higher risk asset class, but this would end up giving me higher returns. But that hasn't been the case. And normally, 5 years, most people are, you know, okay, they are okay if the asset class underperforms. 10 years is a serious question mark. 15 years is a, you know, red flag. I think this asset class will have serious questions. We're already seeing that where people are talking of, you know, emerging market ex-China and stuff like that. Russia has gone out. South Africa, Turkey, nobody wants to invest. So I think a lot of question marks and clouds on this emerging market. So I've always highlighted that emerging market is not a homogeneous asset class. So you have countries which have current account surplus and countries which have current account deficit. You have countries which are, you know, commodity exporting. You have countries which are commodity importing. You have per capita $20,000 country and a per capita $2,000 country, all mixed together. So the sum of parts is zero because the benefit of one negates with the other. How long can this continue? So my point is that this asset class today or tomorrow will crumble. Eventually, people will start looking at subclasses within the asset, maybe, you know, South Asia and stuff like that, North Asia. Something of that sort. And India will stand out there. So even during this period where I said emerging markets haven't given any returns, India has roughly given 6-7% dollar returns over 15 years or 10 years. So it's done reasonably well at a time when emerging markets haven't done well. So that's why I said, in whichever way I look at and cut and slice the whole pie, it looks very interesting. So I'm still quite bullish on India, actually.
India is, would you say India is like where China was in the 90s? Just taking off and like a 10-20 year of massive build out of the economy, you know, manufacturing coming back? Because one of the issues with India has been we skipped the manufacturing, and without manufacturing, there are no jobs, you know, semi-skilled jobs and all, they don't happen. And that's why you have unemployment. But now you think in this 10-20-30 year phase, we could get that right?
But I would still be cautious that we should not look at China and say, okay, China did this. Can India do this? I think both countries are so different. I mean, being a communist, not a democracy, they could do anything. And in those phases, they did very well. So if you see some of these statements that you see from Nirmala Sitharaman, she's actually unhappy that the corporate capex hasn't picked up despite she having reduced the tax to 25% almost 3 years back. You know, it's not so easy in India to expect that you do everything right and you get, you know, this corporate capex, it comes as if there's no tomorrow. The last time we saw something like that was in the 2003-2007 period. And a large part was also driven by, you know, power sector reforms and private sector coming into power. This time around, it's going to be manufacturing. The PLI is helping. So some of the schemes that the government has announced is helping. But is the capex mania really, you know, picked up? I would say companies are still cautious. They're announcing a lot of new capex, but the execution on the ground, I would say, is still tepid.
Yeah. And so I like what you preface this answer by quoting your Xbox boss. India disappoints both the optimists and the pessimists. And I'm just wondering whether this should be the punchline of almost everything, because it's a good way to lead your life, right? You'll be fine. You'll come out just
exactly. Fine. Yeah. So actually, this is good for the markets also. Don't be extremely bullish. Don't be extremely bearish. You'll get up in India. You always get opportunities to invest. As I said, even in the worst period of you know, pandemic, we found a bank which was having more profits than its market cap. So you'll always find something, and it was a large cap. So it wasn't even like
the most unexpected thing came by, huh?
Yeah. So you always find. So I think I've learned over a period that no point being over bullish, no point being over bearish. You find your way and stay invested.
Okay, wonderful. Moving on. Talk to us about reading. How much time do you spend reading? Kind of stuff you read? Is there any global flavor in that? Just a little bit on that, please.
So all my reading is work related. Whatever I read, macro research. I don't read any books. So if you ask me what is the last book you read, I haven't read any books at all. I actually watch a lot of movies. So I speak 5 languages. So I can actually I see movies in 5 languages. So I'm reasonably updated with, you know, because I was in Calcutta, so I speak Bengali. I'm a South Indian, so I speak Tamil and Malayalam.
Are you able to see all those big budget South Indian movies in the original form? Wow.
Yeah,
lucky.
I do. Yeah, I do. In fact, I saw all of them in the original form. Like Drishyam 2 is a Malayalam remake. I saw the Malayalam version, obviously. So I spend a lot of time doing that. Apart from that, whatever time I get, I spend outdoors, which is either playing or traveling.
Do you think knowing multiple languages helps you form better perspectives? Because your mind is just open to so many things that can exist beyond your most immediate.
So often when you speak to people in their own language, they tend to open up far more. And that has been my experience, that given that I know so many languages, I tend to speak to people in language. Sometimes it works if they don't know that I know the language. Uh-huh. Then you know what they don't want.
Icebreaker, huh? Perfect icebreaker.
Yeah, so it does help. I mean, knowing multiple languages is surely a plus.
Multitasking, plus. Multiple languages, high bar for our viewers and listeners. Okay, final question. Any recommendations that you have for the viewers on how to become better wealth creators, not just stock pickers, better wealth creators?
Disciplined asset allocation and staying invested for a long time. So it's a cliche. I mean, the time spent in the market which matters more than timing the market. So just spend as much time as possible. As I say, I normally tell people that just stay invested in a mutual fund, because individually, it's very difficult for you to outperform if it's not your job. If that is your job, it's fine. But and if you're investing in stocks and you're in a job, then invest in stocks which have some relation to the job that you're doing. Because if there is a good news or a bad news, you will be the first to know. In other cases, you're the last to know. So you're holding the baby then till the end. So I would say those are the broad advice I can give. The simpler you keep, the better.
To that, on a lighter note, I'll add, make sure you multitask, learn multiple languages, go out on your jungle jaunts and watch the original Drishyam in Malayalam, you said?
Yes, Malayalam.
Wonderful. On that note, Sridhar, wonderful, wonderful talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for inviting me. Thanks a lot. Yeah, bye.
Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again, and see you at the next edition of the Investor Hour.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.